Earth and Sky.
What I try to do is to look at a piece of legislation or any other initiative from the standpoint of the atmosphere. Just because a bill gets passed and because it even if it gets signed, don't think the job is over. That's the key thing.
You're listening to science journalist Andrew Revkin of the New York Times and Pace University, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Revkin writes the blog .Earth, tagline 9 billion people, one planet. He spoke with us about climate legislation in the U.S., in particular, a new bill introduced in May 2010 that aims to lower greenhouse gas emissions. He also talked about the polarized debate between scientists and climate change skeptics with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar.
Mr. Revkin, welcome to Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science.
Good to be with you.
Now, the U.S. Senate has introduced a climate and energy bill in May of 2010. What do you see in this bill right now as most important for Americans to know about?
Some of the details, well, we won't know really till it's out. It'll be a complicated menu. It's been a bill that's been progressively weakened, which is kind of the way things work in our system. Unfortunately, if you're really concerned about global warming, you got to really look at the details on this bill when it emerges. Now, it will still have offshore drilling, for example. There'll be a lot of provisos on that, but it's the only way practically in our system to build enough of a consensus around legislation to have a chance of passing it to do a lot of compromising. And those who are seriously concerned about moving us away from our existing energy norms get worried about that, and those out there who are realists say, well, this is just the way it is.
And this bill, I guess, addresses the way energy is produced and how that impacts with climate. One of the ways it does this is through this idea of cap and trade. Most people have no idea what cap and trade is. How would you describe what cap and trade is?
It's a setup that's been utilized before. The 1990, the Clean Air Act reauthorization for some other kinds of pollution. Basically, there's a ceiling on emissions that progressively ratchets down. And there are permits granted to industries that and other emitters that are known to emit that pollutant. And you have to pay for the permits. Well, one of the questions about this, by the way, is do some of these permits get initially given away? There's a finite pool of them. Over time, the amount of emissions is shrinking overall, and companies or other institutions that do a better job can cut their emissions quicker, like they can kind of go deeper than the required restriction, they have an excess of credits, and they can sell those to companies or others who are having a harder time. Now, you would say, well, that doesn't really change anything. They're just sort of the ones who are ahead can trade, you know, sort of sell something to someone who's behind. But the overall number keeps declining. So you have a restriction on an emission over time, and the most efficient cuts in the emissions are done by using that kind of market. It's a mechanism that has transaction costs, as they call them. You know, there's buyers and sellers and lawyers and all that stuff. And so that one of the criticisms of this kind of system is it can be pretty opaque, kind of like other financial trading that went on, and that got a lot of people suspicious of the whole enterprise. For the moment, it looks like if it's in the bill, it would be restricted to the power generation sector, to utilities initially, which greatly weakens the potential, sort of the environmental potential of it. And then there would be other measures taken in other arenas, like in the oil arena, to start to shift us away from emissions trends that we've been on for a long time. The goal under the bill will almost certainly be to, by 2020, have about a 17% cut in emissions of greenhouse gases below the levels in 2005. Now, by the way, right now, as I wrote on .Earth recently, we've got declining emissions, although so far it's been significantly because of the economy going into the tank. The question is now, how do you sustain reductions in emissions while you try to grow an economy? That's more challenging.
How do you feel about the progress that's been made so far in meeting the challenges of climate change?
Do you mean nationally, globally, or because there's separate answers there? I mean, I think it's taken ages for the world to even integrate meaningfully the reality that science has shown clearly that humans are building influence on the climate system. There's a lot of variability along the way, and there will remain variability. High, unusual hot periods wicked storms, more droughts. And some of that can confuse and confound the issue. There's plenty of people who are who I call stasists, who are really dead set on not having a shift from today's energy policies. And that's not going to change. Overall, I think we're on a slow path toward integrating into our consciousness that humans are now and will remain for generations a rising influence on the global environment and the climate system, and that comes with risks. And if we're not invested and investing in a sustained and aggressive way and fostering a sort of priming the innovation pipeline so we have new energy technologies, great improvements coming and that can make them cheaper, and finding ways to disseminate those where they're needed, meaning mainly in China and India, if we don't get more engaged on putting this awareness to work, we'll see a period of real potential turmoil. And it's not just because of the climate influence, but we're also peaking everything. And the next two generations, we're heading toward adding two more, the equivalent of two more Chinas to the human population by 2050 or so. And all 9 billion people roughly around that time will be seeking a decent life. That means liking energy, wanting some. And how we make that work out is the great challenge of our time.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on this whole idea that is meeting some resistance right now, that humans actually are not only changing the climate, but they're mostly responsible for changing the climate right now, according to the scientists with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's charged the political climate, I guess, that surrounds climate science right now. There's been back and forth lately between scientists and politicians. How do you see this being resolved?
Well, I think time will show that the body of evidence, again, for a growing human influence on the climate system will continue to grow. And I think you've had two surges that happened in the last several years, that both of which were problematic. The first was an overly confident kind of conclusive sense that we know it all now. This came with the burst of coverage of Katrina as a climate incident, Al Gore's movie, And the Nobel Prize to the IPCC, that whole stretch there was a period when, while on many of the key issues, there's a lot of complexity, that, and one of which being how much of today's climate change recently is our fault. There was, I think, certainly in the environmental campaign community, an oversell of the level of confidence in some of that. And so, you know, and as I've written for many years, the stuff we know confidently is pretty straightforward. More CO2, you know, greenhouse gases actually function. More of them will make the world warmer. Warmer world, less ice, higher seas. All that stuff is a no-brainer. But there was a sense of selling the whole package, the dangerous, disruptive climate change, how much of it, what was happening with hurricanes, all that kind of thing, was oversold. And that level of sort of the overselling of the climate crisis a couple of years ago and the way it was done, I feel, enabled the skeptics and the paid disinformers. Not every skeptic is a professional. There's a whole bestiary of people through the whole climate discourse. Anyway, it enabled people recently to say, oh, they were overstating things, and to foster a sense of doubt. And that was all what you've heard recently, you know, trying to undermine the entire body of research on global warming as being a hoax, that kind of thing, is also a ridiculous overstatement. Beyond overstatement, it's a complete and depending on who's doing the talking, dishonest or at the very least uninformed debate. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to slosh back to it all being the way it was. I think everyone in the scientific, many people in the scientific community have recognized more recently that complexity is real on issues that matter. And this is sea level, for example, the path toward there's still high uncertainty about how high seas could rise by 2100. Arctic sea ice is very complex. It's kind of resurged recently after that extraordinary retreat in 2007. And hurricanes have become much more, the science is much more nuanced now than it was several years ago. So the idea that Katrina is us is ancient history. So, and I think everyone recognizes that in whatever communication effort is done on climate going forward by the scientific community, including the IPCC, there'll have to be much more of an embracing of the complexity and the persistent uncertainty, even when it's inconvenient in some cases, on things that matter a lot to society. the case for action has to incorporate the murkiness, not try to hide it.
How do you see people being able to meet each other somehow in the middle? How would you seek to reconcile this?
Well, one of the reasons I keep blogging, despite all the hassles and headaches of blogging, is I'm trying to facilitate forward-moving discourse that, to some extent, builds from the non-controversial outward toward what actions make sense. In other words, there's many, many reasons some of these people have given for pursuing energy efficiency and that kind of thing. I don't think this will simply be solved by finding some funky middle. What has to be done is finding a way to build. Basically, we have to be brutally honest about where are the problems, where are the gaps, what isn't happening that would have to happen to decarbonize a growing global human population seeking a lot of the things that come with abundant energy. How would you actually do that? And I think it's clear that you can't really get there using traditional 20th century tools, litigation, legislation, and to some extent diplomacy. Those arenas aren't necessarily going to drive the change that would be required. If you really do want to decarbonize by 2050 the global energy economy. And so there you have the sense of, I think you can find ways to get on a new track that aren't going to just fall into the whole catastrophe versus hoax discourse, that you can kind of avoid getting in that trap. And I'm trying to chart that as much as I can amid all the other news and all the other fronts I track on Daughters.
You've been listening to Andrew Revkin, who writes the Dot Earth blog for the New York Times and is currently a senior fellow for environmental understanding at Pace University. To subscribe to this and other free science interview podcasts, visit the subscribe page at earthsky.org. I'm Lindsay Patterson. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.